This is Rank and File Radio on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Carruthers Hall, Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. Rank and File Radio is a weekly program covering labor issues from national and international perspectives. We are your hosts, Doug Nesbitt
and Andrew Stevens. On this week's show, we speak with James Nugent, former chief spokesperson for QP 3902, which represents TAs and invigilators at the University of Toronto. We also interviewed James Meads, co-president of QP 4600, representing TAs and contract faculty at Carleton University.
But first, here's this week's labor news update.
According to Statistics Canada, the number of people receiving regular employment insurance benefits increased by 4,200, or 0.8%, to 544,000 in December. The number of beneficiaries remained relatively stable during the final quarter of the year, but was down over 16.7% compared with 12 months earlier. There were more people receiving benefits in six provinces, with the largest percentage increases occurring in Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and Ontario. The largest decline was observed in Newfoundland and Labrador.
On February 13th, Air Canada pilots, represented by the Air Canada Pilots Association, voted 97% in favor of a strike if necessary to press their contract demands. Pilots have been without a contract since March of 2011. Air Canada's president stated that the company has no intention of imposing a new contract or locking out its pilots. One of the main issues of contention for the pilots is Air Canada's plan to set up a low-cost international carrier whose pilots would earn less than those flying for the main airline. On February 27th, one of the co-mediators appointed by Federal Labor Minister Lisa Raitt resigned from her position. Ms. Otis wrote in her resignation letter that she did not want to be responsible for delaying the mediation process between Air Canada and the Pilots Association due to her other professional commitments in March. Negotiations will continue with the one remaining mediator, Mr. Jacques Lessard. Minister Lisa Raitt reiterated the government's position that any labor disruptions at Air Canada would harm the economy.
Operating profits for Canadian corporations were up 9% to $71.4 billion in the fourth quarter of 2011. This marks the highest level of profits since the economic downturn in late 2008. However, profits were $6.1 billion below the peak in the third quarter of 2008. In the non-financial sector, operating profits in the fourth quarter of 2011 increased 5.3% to $53.5 billion, following a 3.2% gain in the previous quarter. Much of this growth came from the manufacturing industry. Petroleum and coal product manufacturers reported a 25% increase in profits to $3.4 billion in the same period. In the financial sector, operating profits increased 21.8% to $17.9 billion, following a 10.9% decline in the third quarter. Most of the fourth quarter growth came from the insurance industry.
In December, average weekly earnings of non-farm payroll employees were up 0.7% from the previous month, increasing to $888.26. On a year-over-year basis, earnings rose 2.4%. According to the Statistics Canada report, average hours worked per week can also contribute to changes in earnings. The year-over-year increase in weekly earnings was tempered by a decline in average hours worked per week. In December, average hours worked per week were 32.8, down from 32.9 in the previous month.
On February 28th, more than a million Indian workers went on a 24-hour general strike. Banks closed and bus services were canceled as millions of Indian government employees joined a nationwide strike to protest the cost of living and plans to sell stakes in state companies. The workers were also protesting rising prices and demanded respect for workers' rights and labor unions. The one-day stoppage was called by 11 unions from across a political spectrum, including the Indian National Trade Union Congress that's affiliated with the ruling Congress Party. The striking workers want the government to control inflation and provide universal social security for unorganized workers. Previous strikes protested fuel price increases and called for the rollback of now-stalled plans to allow retailers such as Walmart stores to set up supermarkets in India.
Striking Halifax transit workers rejected a so-called final offer from the Halifax Regional Municipality by 78% on February 24th. The union, Amalgamated Transit Union Local 508, has been on strike since February 2nd. The union membership has voted in favor of binding arbitration, but City Council continues to reject the union's overtures. Here is Ken Wilson, president of the union, commenting on the vote.
Everyone ready?
Yeah. Yeah.
That good, Aaron?
Yep.
The numbers were in, 650 votes were casted. The membership has rejected the employer's offer with 78% of the membership not in support of the employer's last offer. I have to say, guys, that the executive told the members that it's their vote. It's a democratic process. We didn't tell them either way. You vote with your heart, you vote with your family. Rostering was still on the table. They were allowing the union to have a little bit more say in it. The members still weren't comfortable with the wording, more so we could have suggestions not mutually agree with. It was a five-year deal, but it was a 9% raise over 5 years, and a one-time $1,500 payment the first year. And we've always said this before, guys, the members want quality of life. There's other ways to look at these 85 open pieces of work than rostering. And for some reason, council doesn't listen and management doesn't listen. We can fix this. This was all created because of the last round of bargaining in 06 when they created the eight-hour rule. And that's what created these open shifts. And that's why we have all these open pieces of work. So that's where it's at right now, guys, to be honest.
Did you say 70 or 78?
78%.
So what happens now?
Well, this is, I'm going to put it out there. I left a message for the conciliator, John Greer. I told him the numbers, and if the employer wants to go back to the table and negotiate properly, instead of council bypassing us and going to the membership, we're more than welcome to go back to the negotiating table.
So it was rostering that you wouldn't agree with?
It was rostering. It was no accident review. It was no wage increase in the first year. It was everything. It was the whole process. You know what the biggest thing I heard from the members this morning? What is going on? Council won't go to you, they'll go to us. That's not how the process plays out. We're supposed to negotiate at a table. We're supposed to go through both committees. And I said in there to the membership, I said, you know what, if this happens to get rejected, maybe I'll just send a proposal to council and bypass HRM's management, because that's what they did to me. And that's not how the process should take place.
But you said there was a lot of changes.
The employer pulled a lot of concessions off the table. I'm not going to lie, guys. They did exactly that. You know, it's funny. Just before the strike happened, they took rostering off but left the 70 concessions on the table. We go back to negotiate with rostering what we thought was off the table, and they put rostering back on the table and wouldn't take the concessions off the table. And now they take the concessions off the table with rostering. So yeah, I don't know what the next document's going to look like. I really don't. If binding arbitration is still the union's position at this point, we will go back to the table and negotiate. Our bargaining team has to sit down and discuss our next move. And we'll go from there. We always wanted to bring it back to the membership. If there was enough change, there was enough change to bring it back. The members have spoken, and it's a democratic process. We'll respect the members, 78% in favor to reject, so we're still on strike as of today.
The United Food and Commercial Workers reported on February 20th that 1,500 unionized Zellers workers at 12 Ontario stores ratified a three-year contract. The agreement included wage increases and stronger severance packages. The issue of severance has become central given the recent buyout of 189 Zeller stores by Target, the American retail giant. Target intends to lay off 10,000 Zeller's workers and allow them to reapply for their jobs. It is unclear how Target intends to deal with the minority of unionized Zeller stores. Canadian labor law has well-established precedents for workers to remain unionized despite the change of ownership. In response, the UFCW has launched a national campaign centered around the website targetfairness.ca and has held awareness-raising actions outside Zeller stores to inform consumers. In other retail workers' news, workers with the UFCW at Ontario's Metro grocery stores voted 97% in favor of a strike mandate on February 24th. The union, representing 10,000 workers, and the employer, are entering into conciliation talks on March 6th and 7th with the Ontario Ministry of Labour.
After nearly 2 months on the picket line, the nearly 500 locked-out workers of London, Ontario's shuttered electromotive diesel plant voted 95% in favor of a severance package negotiated between their union, the Canadian Auto Workers, and Caterpillar, the company which owns the plant. This brings to end a sorry episode of anti-union corporate greed that shocked millions of Canadians. The workers were locked out on New Year's Day when they refused the 50% pay cut and elimination of pensions demanded by Caterpillar. To add insult to injury, the plant was given a $5 million corporate tax break by Prime Minister Harper's federal government. While the union describes the severance package as excellent, it's a bittersweet end to a labor dispute that sparked a mass rally of 10,000 on January 21st, a week-long train blockade in Ingersoll, and numerous solidarity actions across the country.
The lockout at Alma Quebec's Rio Tinto aluminum smelter is soon to enter its third month. Organized labor is planning a mass rally in Alma on March 30th to support the 750 locked-out steelworkers. The smelter remains operational at one-third capacity through the use of scab labor, which the steelworkers argue violates the province's anti-scab legislation. The major issue that sparked the lockout was the attempt to increase contract labor at the smelter from 10% to 27% of the workforce. The lockout is not unlike what happened in London, Ontario. Like Caterpillar, Rio Tinto made enormous profits in 2011.
That's this week's Labor News Update. Stay tuned for our interviews with James Nugent and James Meads. We'll be right back.
There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part, you can't even passively take part, and you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop, and you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Rank and File Radio, a program about work, the labor movement, and sticking it to the man.
Tune in Wednesday evenings, 5:30 to 6 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM. On Friday, February 24th, a meeting of Unit 1 members of QP 3902 at the University of Toronto resolved to send a proposed collective agreement, which was recommended by the local's bargaining committee, to the general membership for a vote. The results of this vote will determine if that agreement will serve as the collective agreement governing employment for graduate student and postdoctoral TAs, course instructors, and invigilators at the U of T. Members of Unit 1 will have a chance to vote on the proposed contract today, February 29th, Monday, March 5th, and Tuesday, March 6th. I'm joined today on the phone with James Nugent, former chief spokesperson for QP 3902. James, thanks for speaking with Rank and File Radio.
Thank you for having me here. Thank you.
What were the contentious issues addressed during the negotiations between the U of T administration and QP 3902 bargaining teams?
Yeah, we had a bunch of small issues, and then we had sort of three big issues coming into the last week of negotiations. Some of the smaller issues had to do with hiring transparency, so trying to make sure that jobs were posted online and that people were notified that they actually received a job, believe it or not. Also, parental leave and support, some kind of training for course instructors. But the big three issues had to do with, first of all, tutorials and labs. We have a situation where these tutorials and labs, which are supposed to be small, intimate discussions, have become unwieldy, huge classrooms where we have 25% of tutorials are over 50 students now. The second big issue had to do with the technical loophole that the administration has been exploiting during the term of our last collective agreement. They found a way to basically make us work, give us more work for the same amount of pay. And then the third issue has to do with senior student funding, which was cut last year and had a huge impact for many senior students. So those are the three big issues that we were facing coming into the later stages of bargaining.
The latest contract offer that's being voted on starting today, what's in it? And really, what's not included?
Right. Well, I mean, I do commend the bargaining team for their 8 months of hard work. It does the contract that's on the table for discussion and for voting right now. It does address some of the smaller issues, and so, for example, we did actually get the administration to agree to post jobs online. Hopefully, I mean, we've gotten a working group to deal with that issue, but the hope is that they'll come to their senses and put jobs online and let us know when we got them. We did get a 1 week parental leave for the spouse or partner whose baby was born, to get 1 week off there, and a few more hours for training for course instructors. But what I want to make clear is that you know, these issues, these are the smaller things that have been signed off, they've been agreed to, and they're not the outstanding issues. The outstanding issues have to do with the tutorials and labs. Like I said, you know, tutorials and labs are getting huge at the University of Toronto, which has classes of thousands of students. And so, you know, students need to be able to have small, intimate discussions. And when you have 42% of tutorials over 35, the university's proposal isn't sufficient. What they've proposed is to create a working group, which will, you know, examine the issue and kind of report back to the provost. Well, you know, this might be a novel idea if it hadn't already been tried at the end of the last round of bargaining. After you know, we bargained last time, they created this working group. This is where the numbers I'm giving you have come from. And it didn't implement any changes. It just basically said that TAs need to be trained better. So we can't accept a working group as a way of dealing with these quality of education issues. The second thing that the university has put on the table has to do with this technical loophole I'm talking about. Basically, what the administration has been able to do is decrease the amount of compensation that graduate students get for their dissertation research. As we know, U of T is one of the most innovative and prestigious research institutions, and behind that research are teams of graduate students doing the research. And so what they've done is they've decreased this fellowship about over $3,000, up to $3,000 per student. And they've made us basically work back that money by doing what we call taxable research assistantships. So that's what they've decided. You know, and this affects thousands of students. And like I said, it's up to, you know, $3,200. And they've really just put some change on the table in the amount of a one-time payment of $150,000 for 2 years. And so that's just insufficient. And finally, the last issue with senior student funding. I mean, they cut a fund that was worth $4 million. They've reinstated this fund, but they've made it used to be a grant, and now it's a competitive award, and not all students can get this grant, and so they've thrown $250,000, again a one-time only payment for 2 years that they think is going to solve this problem.
Should the over 7,000 members of 3902 vote against the recent contract?
Okay, I just want to be clear that our bargaining unit is only 4,500 or 4,200 of those 7,000. But it's clear to me that there is still more work to do, and that this collective agreement that they've offered is premature and that it's inadequate. So I do think that UP 3902 members should be voting this down.
Why did you resign as chief spokesperson for the Unit 1 of QP 3902?
Well, the reason that I resigned as the chief spokesperson and the representative of Divisional 2, which is social sciences, is actually quite simple. Simply, I just feel that this agreement is inadequate and is premature. And the only way that I could actually speak against this agreement and to raise some critical problems with the agreement was to actually step down from my position on the bargaining team and to speak against these issues from the floor of the membership meeting.
QP 3902, Unit 1 specifically, has a strong strike mandate. Is that correct? Or has received?
We had a strike vote in November, and 91% of our members who voted in that strike vote, which had the highest turnout we've ever had, voted in favor of a strike should the administration not seriously address our key issues.
Do you think this is a time for the unit to exercise that strike mandate?
I think that the strike should definitely be an important consideration as a tool for negotiations. We know that strikes oftentimes are necessary to make employers come to their senses. And so I think that at this point, it's not for me to decide whether or not a strike happens. I'm just one rank-and-file member. What we need to have is a discussion about the merits of this agreement. We need to have it come back. Members, I think, in my opinion, should vote this down. We should come back into a membership meeting and make a decision about where we want to go, what direction we want to take in terms of this this round of bargaining. I think that we've never been so prepared for a strike. We've had a fantastic strike committee mobilization team. We've had departmental meetings. We've talked to everybody many, many times. Everything is lined up. The daycare is ready to go. The buses are ready for the suburban campuses. We've got food logistics ready to go. So I think people need to be reassured that we are 100% ready to hit the picket lines if that's what we choose to do. But again, I think we need to come back to the membership, have a meeting, and basically decide from there.
I'm wondering if you could comment on really the state of labor unionism on campuses and generally the state of public education in Ontario, given the recent release of the report by Don Drummond, the former chief economist with TD.
Yeah, it's very difficult when you're in the middle of negotiations and you're trying to get members to understand the issues and to embolden members with that they have a right to go on strike, for example, if the administration is refusing to negotiate seriously with us. When at the same time you have Don Drummond being solicited by the provincial government to tell workers across the province that they have no rights, that they really have to just take cuts, they have to take cutbacks, and that basically that a few people are going to decide the fate of post-secondary education in this province. So it creates a very difficult bargaining environment. That's, I think, something that we've had to deal with. Fortunately, though, we have been working over the past year on really making sure our members have had input into this process. And so, we've had surveys, we've had info sessions, we've had QP cafes, lunch times every twice a week for the entire semester, last semester. We've had town halls, membership meetings, and so this type of information and consultation and everything else, I think, really made people aware that something has to get done. But for sure, the Don Drummond report doesn't help things. I mean, he wants to turn universities into online schools. 3 of 5 courses he wants students to be taking online. How can you be learning in that environment? In some disciplines, you can't really do that. You need to have the types of tutorials we're talking about.
James, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
That was our interview with James Nugent, former chief spokesperson for QB 3902.
Did you know CFRC is turning 90 on October 7th? We hit the airwaves 11 days before the BBC was formed in 1922. Our 10th anniversary came 6 days after Babe Ruth called that home run hit at the 1932 World Series. Our 30th birthday fell a month after CBC made its debut in Montreal in 1952. We turned 40 when the first James Bond movie came out. In 1972, we were half a century old when Atari released the first arcade video game. By the time we were 80 in 2002, the Flaming Lips topped the campus and community radio charts. And what's in store this year? Stay tuned into us as we make a little history of our own together. You'll see us and hear us at tons of local concerts and events all year long. You'll dance with us at our free monthly DJ nights. You'll be up to date with all the latest news on your campus, in your community, and around the world. You'll listen to the widest variety of music and informative spoken word radio brought to you by our dedicated volunteers. You'll even go to our website, www.cfrc.ca, to find out how you can get involved with the best radio station around. This is CFRC 101.9 FM. Thanks for listening all these years, and with your support, we'll be around in 90 more.
Teaching assistants at Carleton University are facing a significant loss of income due to a payroll error that has gone uncorrected for 2 years since the last collective agreement was signed between the TA union, QP 4600, and the employer. The average Carleton TA earns $8,900 a year, and the university is seeking upwards of $1,600 in what the union is calling wage theft. Rank and File Radio is speaking today with James Meads, co-president of QP 4600. How did the union first learn that the Carleton administration was planning to cut TA wages mid-contract?
We were sent an email on February 3rd from the administration informing us that they had discovered a human programming error which had led to the incorrect implementation of tuition index protection, which is under our collective agreement as a salary benefit. This resulted in students receiving tuition rebates in years in which they weren't qualified. They then informed us that they would be seeking to recoup the amount over the next six pay periods. They didn't quite get their act together in time, so then it became the next five pay periods. And now what they've tried to do after serious pressure from numerous TAs in the union is actually just put this amount, quote-unquote, owing onto student accounts.
So what has the union's response been so far?
We've had sort of two very, very direct responses. One is that we don't feel that TAs, who are the most precarious and underpaid employees on the campus, should be responsible for paying for the mistake of the administration. As well, we're requesting that they improve the way which our pay, our scholarships and whatnot, deductions are presented to us online so that everything is clearly laid out and people can easily see what money they are receiving in wages, what money they're receiving in scholarships.
And what has the membership response been like?
The membership response has been incredibly positive, at least in terms of the actions we've taken. I mean, the vast majority of TAs are incredibly frustrated and angered with the way that Carleton has handled this. And they are, willing to participate in info pickets and sign grievance forms and petitions. They're taking the same position as us, that we won't put up with this.
Is there any sort of legal precedent or a legal route that the union can take to stop this from happening?
There are a few. One is called sort of a promissory estoppel, which says that the money that was paid to TAs was sort of basically considered as pay, and that to requad retroactively is essentially illegal. We are looking into trying to work through a grievance process that would most likely end up in arbitration. As well, there are federal precedents. Actually, the PSAC, Public Service Alliance of Canada, has produced a document on past cases where employers have offered benefits to employees through error, then tried to claw them back, and it was held that they were unable to do that. We also believe that to directly claw back wages is a violation of the Employment Standards Act, specifically under Article 13. Unless they were to seek consent from members or a court order, either of which they have done. The big difficulty for us now legally is that by them trying to put this on the student accounts, they're trying to shift the discussion from a labor issue to a student issue. So we have to explore other avenues.
You're also vice president of QP Ontario's University Workers Coordinating Committee, a body representing several dozen QP locals on Ontario campuses. Does this dispute at Carleton have any implications for the sector as a whole?
I would say yes. We just had our annual meeting, and it's clear that QP locals on other Ontario University campuses are full support of us, and we'll lend their assistance where it can be offered or needed. But if we were to allow Carleton to undertake this course of action as they seem to want to, it would set a dangerous precedent for other university campuses.
Can you comment on the recent report authored by former TD economist Don Drummond and what this means for the post-secondary education sector in Ontario?
Well, the Drummond report itself, 562 pages of it, is a fairly impenetrable document. terms of the specific recommendations that he made about post-secondary education, we can see that, you know, increasing class sizes, that increasing tuition fees, that cutting the new quote-unquote McGinty grant, all of these steps are part of his report and recommendation. If they were to be implemented, the already unsustainable sort of budgetary crisis facing Ontario universities would be made much, much worse, and it would be put on the backs of students and workers to pay for this.
Going back to the issue at Carleton, what can teaching assistants, students, academic workers across Ontario and beyond do to help QP 4600?
There's a few things. You can follow us on Twitter or join our Facebook group to keep sort of on top of the issue and help, you know, start conversations on different campuses. We are encouraging people to sign our online petition, and we are more than welcome for anybody that wants to send letters, emails to our university president, Roseanne Rente, or our VP of Finance, Duncan Watt, or to HR, to Liz Levine, anything that says that basically that, you know, people are in support of QP 4600, or they're in support of our members, and that they too don't feel that we should be the ones held accountable for their mistake.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Okay. No problem at all.
That was James Meads, co-president of QP 4600 at Carleton University. That's all the time we have this week. Find us on Facebook and listen to previous shows on radioforall.net. Join Rank and File Radio again next Wednesday, 5:30 to 6 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM. Stay tuned.
Ain't no need to discuss it. Just take this job and shove it right between your buttocks.